The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio met with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to discuss peace in Ukraine in what he described as the first step on a long journey to end the war. Those discussions happened, of course, without Ukraine being present. And later, President Donald Trump seemed not to understand who actually started the war, and he pivoted the U.S. stance to be much closer to that of Russia's. At a press conference, he was asked about those talks and if he was more or less confident of a deal after them.
Well, much more confident. They were very good. Russia wants to do something. They want to stop the savage barbarianism. I mean, what's going on over there? Its soldiers are being killed by the thousands on a weekly basis. It's ridiculous. And they're not American soldiers. They're Russian soldiers and they're Ukrainian soldiers largely, although a lot of Koreans have been killed, as you know. Quite a bit of them have been killed. They came over to fight and a large portion have been wiped out. But we want to end it. It's a senseless war. It should have never happened, would have never happened if I was president. And it's a shame to see it. And I see pictures that you don't see, but I see pictures of fields that look just horrible. It looks like Gettysburg. If you see the old pictures of Gettysburg, it's soldiers lying all over the field, body parts all over the field. They're all dead. And this is going on a daily basis. It's a horrible thing. Both Russia and Ukraine, they're losing thousands and thousands of soldiers. And a lot of people have been killed, too. I think that's one of the things that you'll see historically and you'll see later on as it goes along. I think people are going to be surprised at how many people, not only soldiers, have been killed in Ukraine. A lot more people than you think.
And later in the press conference, he discussed Ukraine having a seat at the table for negotiations.
I want to see peace. Look, you know why I want? Because I don't want all these people killed anymore. I'm looking at people that are being killed, and they're Russian and Ukrainian people, but they're people. Doesn't matter where they're from on the whole planet. And I think I have the power to end this war. And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. I could have made a deal for Ukraine that would have given them almost all of the land, everything, almost all of the land, and no people would have been killed, and no city would have been demolished, and not one dome would have been knocked down. But they chose not to do it that way.
So, Ukraine should never have started it, despite the fact that Russia, of course, started the war by taking Crimea, first of all, in 2014, and then the invasion 3 years ago. He was then asked about reports that Russia wants new elections in Ukraine in order to sign a peace deal, and if that was something he would support.
Well, we have a situation where we haven't had elections in Ukraine, where we have martial law, essentially martial law in Ukraine, where the leader in Ukraine, I mean, I hate to say it, but he's down at 4% approval rating, and where a country has been blown to smithereens. You got most of the cities are laying on their sides. The buildings are collapsed. It looks like a massive demolition site. So many of the cities. I mean, they haven't done it in Kiev because I guess they don't want to shoot too many rockets in there. They've done it 20%, but they haven't done it 100%. If they wanted to do it 100%, it would probably happen very quickly. But you have cities that are absolutely decimated. And, yeah, I would say that, you know, when they want a seat at the table, you could say the people have to, wouldn't the people of Ukraine have to say, like, you know, it's been a long time since we've had an election. That's not a Russia thing. That's something coming from me and coming from many other countries also.
And despite Trump's apparent willingness to toe the line, similar to Russia, two Republican senators were very clear yesterday on their opinion of Vladimir Putin.
Any sort of peace talks that might get a fair result would definitely need to have the Ukrainians at the table and make sure that European interests are considered and carefully weighed.
Do you think that Putin can be trusted in these negotiations?
No. Putin is a war criminal and should be in jail for the rest of his life, if not executed.
Vladimir Putin has a black heart. He clearly has Stalin's taste for blood. And there are some people in this world, they're not mixed up, they're not confused, They're not sick. It's not that their mama or daddy didn't love them enough. There's bad people, and they hurt other people, sometimes for enjoyment, and they take other people's stuff, and some of those people run countries, and one of them is Vladimir Putin. He's an evil man.
Senators Roger Wicker and John Kennedy, both Republicans, speaking to CNN's Manu Raju. We're joined now by Paul Rogers, Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
The carve-up of Ukraine has begun. We saw Marco Rubio and Sergei Lavrov in Riyadh beginning, I suppose, a détente between the United States and Russia.
Yes, and I think this is very difficult for Western Europeans to take. There is still this sense in Western Europe of the reality of the Cold War, even though it ended, 35 years ago, and a view of Russia as the enemy, and even though it is very much a capitalist power, in a sense, almost the communist enemy. That's still bound up. And this is why I think the idea of such a complete transition, particularly in the context of the Ukraine war, it finds a great difficulty in sort of going down with many Europeans. I don't know what the mood is like in the United States, and it'll be interesting to look at that, although the clips you were just showing, listing of the American senators, both of them Republicans, very much opposed to Russia, is indicative of, I think there are splits. But you have this extraordinary sort of stance you're getting from Trump himself, going on often on an extraordinary tangent. But behind it, I think what we have to see is there is this mood in Washington, which goes well beyond Trump himself and very much among the many people around him, that essentially Russia is a powerful country, a Western-style country in terms of a free market economy, and we can do business with them. It's worth remembering that one of the key people at the meeting yesterday, Steve Witkoff, who's the key person as far as the Middle East is concerned for the Trump administration, is himself a property billionaire. So people know very much about doing business. They want to do business with Russia and really cut across everything else. To be blunt about it, Ukraine is rather getting in the way, and they want that dealt with. It's a very brutal thing to say, but I think that's where we are really at the moment.
So we have a growing kleptocracy in the United States, a growing autocracy as well, and it is beginning to mirror what has happened in Russia post their crash.
I think that's true, yes. And this is what people are having real difficulty getting to grips with. And they don't know how far it's going to go. One of the issues in all of this is that in some extent we've been here before. We have to remember that in the 1990s, towards the end of the 1990s, we had this great sort of move of the neoconservatives to really give us the, what was it, the project on the new American century. And when in fact Bush got in 2000 and took office in 2001, saw all these withdrawals from the multilateral agreements. So to some extent, that was a variant, although this time it is different in that this is all rooted in money and trade, whereas there was a sense that United States had a sort of an almost God-given mission to lead the world to a finer place. So we're in a different position here to some extent, but we've been here before. And of course, that ended in terrible tears with what happened in Afghanistan, when the United States was determined, utterly determined, to defeat the Taliban, get rid of Al-Qaeda, and it took 20 years before they realized they couldn't do it. So we're really in a very strange time at the moment, and I rather suspect that, particularly given Trump's own extraordinary behavior and the things he comes out with, they may run into difficulty pretty early on. But that really is no reassurance for the situation we're in at the moment.
I was looking at the meeting yesterday and the body language of Marco Rubio, who looked distinctly uncomfortable and maybe even out of place. And there's a cartoon in the Times of London this morning, which has a giant Sergei Lavrov on one side of the table and a tiny Marco Rubio on the other. Little Marco never looked so little. And the line is Lavrov saying to him, "You want peace? Which piece of Ukraine you want?"
Yes, I have not seen that one. But yes, Lavrov is a hugely experienced operator, far more so than Rubio. But beyond that, I think there will be a lot of concern on in some quarters in Washington, way beyond the sort of the firm supporters of the opposition, that they're concerned with what is actually happening now, that in a sense, the United States may come out of this politically very badly, even if it thinks it can do economic business with Russia. And one must remember that Russia does not have a large economy. You know, the economy of the whole of Russia is about the same as Germany. It's a fraction of what you have in the United States. It has loads of gas and oil, of course, but it is not really in the same region in terms of its economic power.
Now, the aforementioned Senator Roger Wicker, who is the chair of the Armed Forces Committee, he was also the one who labelled the speech of Hegseth as a rookie mistake.
Yes, I think this is one of the issues that we're seeing. I mean, if, for example, Trump does want to ensure that you do not get anything like the current number of U.S. service people active abroad, then obviously what he's talking about is cutting back on the whole defense capability of the United States. Now, that will go down very badly with the military-industrial complex, and that's an extremely powerful lobby. Maybe Trump thinks he can take that on, but I'm not at all sure. And what that comment then, I think, was a marker for a potential problem within the administration. I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that with all the cutbacks that Musk is putting through, essentially the Pentagon has been left to one side, that is not being cut back. And that, I think, is an indication of where the power lies. But if you find that Trump's policies actually affect that and affect the capabilities of the American armed forces, then I think he will have internal domestic problems of the pork barrel sort, which really going to make it very difficult for him.
Now, when they fired key personnel who were in charge of the inventory of nuclear weapons, they had to unfire them very quickly. And then it appears they couldn't even find the people they had fired. And Musk, in his famous Oval Office appearance with his son on his shoulders, had said, yeah, you know, we're not perfect, we will make mistakes, but we'll rectify them very quickly. But that kind of bungling by Musk, and it appears he's not the head of Doge, by the way. That's another most extraordinary thing. He's employed in some way as an advisor to the White House, but he's not, in fact, officially the head of Doge, even though he's calling the shots. It's all very complicated and chaotic.
It is indeed, and we're also seeing that many of the people that Trump has brought in may be people who very much believe in what he stands for, but are very young and inexperienced. And essentially, they may be very good on the high-tech side, but that is not the same as doing everyday politics with people who are finding their world turned upside down. So yes, I think there are more problems developing than one expects. And remember, we're only 4 weeks into this, and so much is happening so quickly that I would hate to predict where we'll be in 6 months' time. But I suspect the Trump administration will be already beginning to be tarnished by that time. But that may be as wishful thinking, because like many people, I think there's huge concern in the way that it is going at the moment.
I mean, it does appear he is, to some extent, the Teflon Don. His prediction that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, walk away and get away with it appears to be true. Not that he has directly killed anyone yet. However, his impunity is quite remarkable.
Yes, it is. And I think this is something which he feels. It's the nature of the character of the person, I think, and it is actually important here. He does believe that he is absolutely right. He's not concerned if people disagree with him. He's certainly very concerned if it isn't noticed. But since basically he will carry on because he believes what he's doing is right, even if it's something which is almost spur of the moment, then we're dealing with an unusual character. Now, you get this to some extent in major leaders worldwide with considerable power. You see it in many autocrats. But this is at a level of a man who has huge power in a country which is easily the most powerful in the world militarily, and still the largest, I think, economically in terms of his impact. And of course, that does also explain why there may be a very good reason to do better business with Russia. And the feeling is that it's the Chinese that you have to watch, and they are the major danger for the future.
Now, it's interesting that he, on Truth Social, he quoted a Napoleon, but of course it wasn't Napoleon at all. It was Rod Steiger as Napoleon in a movie. And the quote was something to do with, "He who saves his country does not violate any law."
Yes, it reminds me of Barry Goldwater's quote, what, 50 years ago, that violence in the cause of democracy is no bad thing, or words to that effect. Basically said, anything is allowed in terms of what you need to do to prevent, to defend your country. That's a difficult thing to say, and I think one should perhaps remember, although it was Rod Steiger in the film, a very good film in many ways, that you had to remember what happened to Napoleon. So here again, caution is desirable. It's not one I would quote, certainly.
Now, the US is not going to commit troops to Ukraine to keep the peace, as it were, in a buffer zone or whatever might result from peace talks, which is interesting. And on the other hand, we have Sergei Lavrov saying no way can NATO troops patrol the buffer zone. And he's even wary of any troops coming from countries who are members of NATO being in that buffer zone.
Yes, I mean, that's. I think that's a negotiating ploy.
Sure.
But of course, the relevance here is that one of the countries that's within the NATO zone, so to speak, with more experience of peacekeeping than just about any other, is, of course, Ireland. So it's an interesting take there in terms of where that comes in, because it may well be that something will be resolved eventually, which will be essentially within the UN realm, rather than in the sort of neo-NATO role. And that, of course, will raise interesting questions for Dublin.
Indeed it will, Paul. Thank you very much for joining us. You've actually cued in my next guest, who is Cathal Berry, former member of the Defence Forces. So, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Cathal, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
So we're on to you to talk about the prospect of Irish troops serving on a peacekeeping force in Ukraine. What say you?
Well, yeah, it's certainly a possibility, Pat, for sure. I suppose the first question we'd have to ask is there going to be a ceasefire? Yes or no? Second question then is there going to be a multinational stabilization or monitoring force going into Ukraine on the ground? That's a yes or no question. And if both of those questions or answers to those questions are yes, then there is quite a large probability, I would say, that Ireland would be expected to contribute in some way or form. And probably about a mechanized rifle company of about 150 troops is probably something that would be worth considering.
Okay, that seems like a small token contribution to what will have to be a significant force.
Absolutely. So the estimations are that they will need about between 30 and 50,000 troops. So the line of contact is 1,000 kilometres long. So it's like driving from Cork to Dublin and doing it twice. So it's a massive area. And there's not many troops left, particularly in Ireland. Our own defence forces are at its lowest strength in over 50 years. So half a century, it's never been so low. But we have a small advantage in that we have about 150 troops on standby at the moment with an EU battle group, and their armoured vehicles are actually already in Germany, so they're actually based here on standby in Ireland at very high readiness, and they could deploy at short notice if there was a government decision to deploy them in a few weeks or a couple of months.
Would there be an appetite within the defence forces to participate?
Absolutely. There is a perception, of course, that wearing a blue beret are much safer missions, but it's not the case at all. Actually, all Ireland's fatalities as a result of enemy action have been on Blue Beret United Nations missions. Ireland has participated for the last 25 years on NATO-led and EU-led missions, but there's been no fatalities on any of those missions at all. So, I suppose, paradoxically, the United Nations missions are far more dangerous, and the ones involving EU and NATO forces are less so.
Okay, but wearing the blue beret would kind of be consistent with our stance of military neutrality, one presumes, even though we might be hand in glove with troops from NATO countries.
Yeah, I mean, we would have deployed, Ireland as a country would have deployed troops to NATO missions all over the Balkans and in Chad as well, an EU mission there, and Interfet in East Timor as well. So Ireland would have experience in both blue beret missions and also non-blue beret missions as well. So we'll see how that plays out. So I suppose the key question at the moment is there going to be a ceasefire? And it does look like that's going to take hold probably around April. And then the next question is there going to be a stabilisation force going in? And if so, then Ireland would most likely be a contributing nation, probably about a company-sized rent. The difficulty is, of course, is Ireland has such a small number of troops left, particularly after the cutbacks in the last 15 years. It's going to be very, very hard to sustain that level of troop deployment out there if it lasts longer than 6 or 12 months.
All right. So would this in some way mitigate maybe the bad taste that some Europeans might have about us and our kind of keeping our hands out of these kind of conflicts?
Yeah, it would certainly help. But I suppose we must remember as well that it's in Ireland's vital national interests that the war in Ukraine is brought to a just and a durable end. We have 100,000 Ukrainian refugees here in Ireland, many of whom wish to return to Ukraine as soon as it's safe to do so. And it would also have the added advantage of freeing up a lot of accommodation here for our own housing crisis. So it's absolutely in Ireland's vital national interest that if there is a deployment taking place internationally, that Ireland would meaningfully contribute as well. And the fact that we do have troops on standby at very high readiness, they'd be the obvious call sign, the obvious formed unit to deploy if a political decision was made.
Cathal, thank you very much for joining us, former member of the Defence Forces, Cathal Berry. Now, some of the comments coming in. Ukraine was used by NATO and the EU in the hope they could destroy Russia. Zelensky was ready to sign a peace agreement, but was blocked by Boris Johnson, according to that texter. It was a proxy war between the neocons in Washington and Russia. Putin calling for an election in Ukraine is a joke. He's rigged his own election in Russia, rigged referendums, rigged the judicial system, and murdered Alexei Navalny, the main opposition leader. Trump also is a psychopath. This one, to be fair, it was US advisors that destroyed Russia after the fall as well. That's from David. And there is a long conversation to be had about whether or not NATO was too avaricious in pushing eastward and therefore threatening what Russia calls its sphere of influence. We've talked about it on the program before, and events in Eastern Europe with the change of regimes and so on maybe muddy the waters there. Trump is nothing more than a Russian agent, and Putin is his handler. After all, Putin played a huge role in getting Trump elected in 2016, and now it is payback time. The roots of this depressing mess go back to Obama and Merkel. Both were weak and ultimately empty. They conceded to Putin at every turn. That's from Andrew in Dublin. And a final one. The US economy is in decline, hence all the cutbacks. Trump does not want to spend money on supplying Ukraine with weapons and training, so Ukraine will be left to swing in the wind. Europe has to step up to fill that gap, or else Russian tanks will be rolling down the streets of EU countries and probably invited in by Orban in Hungary. So there you are. Anyway.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.